Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm thrilled to have John Keane. He's the author of a collection of stories and novellas called Counter Narratives. It's published by the venerable press, New Directions, and it's appropriate that it be from New Directions in the world of Make It New, the command Ezra Pound made. New Directions has been making it new since their foundation, and Counter Narratives, these stories and novellas, they're very new in the fiction of the Americas. It helps to say the fiction of the Americas because it would be a mistake to think that all of these stories take place in North America and therefore are American. There are stories that take place in Brazil. There are stories that take us up to Canada. There are stories that take us across centuries. And there are characters that end the story as a different sex than the sex they began with. Now, I assume that all of these things is why you call it counter-narratives. But tell me why.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about when I, really shortly after I published the very first of these stories, well, I really first wrote it, but then published it, was how, in a sense, it functioned as a kind of counter-narrative to the sort of master narratives that I had grown up hearing and that are so pervasive. That story was an outtake from the ideological origins of the American Revolution. And it struck me, I think, as really quite fascinating that at the moment when our country was in a pitched battle for its freedom, we had a kind of radical unfreedom that was in place and that would actually take even deeper root shortly thereafter. So I realized that what I'd written was a kind of counter-narrative. And as I began assembling the book, putting the stories together, and then as that process gained steam, I realized that all of these were in various ways counter-narratives, even sometimes to each other.
Now, what do you mean by radical unfreedom?
Well, I was thinking primarily of slavery and the fact that Massachusetts, I believe, was the first state to legalize slavery, but it also was, and it, you know, is the cradle of American freedom, in a sense. But it also was the place where abolitionism took deepest root. So in a sense, you know, that kind of radical unfreedom and radical freedom were existing side by side.
We think that history belongs to the winners.
Mm-hmm.
We say this all the time.
Yeah.
But language belongs to the winners too.
Mm-hmm.
And we speak English because the French were defeated, the Dutch were defeated, the first people were defeated. Our language, the language that a person enslaved strove to learn, was English,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily his or her own language.
Right.
So I think of these as being counter narratives, as being counter to the very idea that language is imposed. Mm-hmm. These stories are written in a sense, the different tongues of narrative.
Mm-hmm.
There are histories, mm-hmm. there are poems, mm-hmm. there are documents, there are diaries, mm-hmm. there are dreams written in the invented language of dream. And we're not going to be hearing what we think of as the simplicities, the causes and effects. This and then that, and consequently this. These are going to be put aside. What was it that you were seeking? Because I found these stories fascinating and as unlike the stories that I think of when I think of stories as possible. I was thrilled to be finding something genuinely new.
In a sense, with each story, and I think it's more evident in some than others, right, there are these moments of disruption where the language does unusual things, the English language, right? I mean, there's actually eruptions into English throughout of other languages. So English, as we know it, or standard English, sits side by side, for example, with Spanish and with Portuguese and with Chickasaw at one point and with Haitian Creole. But in terms of thinking about how language, and particularly in contemporary American literature, functions, I wanted to go against the grain, even at the level of sentences, of paragraphs, and of course of form, to, in a sense, from the ground up or from the bottom up, tell stories in which the language was as true to the story itself, as opposed to imposing as the author what I thought the language should look and sound like.
In one of the most, say, direct stories is a story called Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
As it happens, it's about Jim, who we know from Huckleberry Finn. It's called Rivers because he's taken Rivers as a last name. It's not because of the nights on the rivers that Huck and Jim spent. It's a counter-narrative to that. The Jim we know left a wife and children behind. This Jim is very faithful, but his faithfulness begins in a ménage à trois. He's involved with two women. They're involved with one another. One of them has two children. So we're not going to have the conventional Jim, the conventional Mark Twain, or the conventional relationships. But none of these people have the haunted sense that we like to think of when we think of Huckleberry Finn and we're trying to define it as an American narrative that has something important to say about race.
Mm-hmm.
What your story does is explore the fact that racial hatred is not easily suspended and not easily defined, huh?
Right. But what I also wanted to show was the complexity even at that moment, right? This moment, not just before the war, as is the case, or as was the case with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, but after the war, this the kind of fluidity of feeling, of feelings, of interactions between people of different races, because it's never as cut and dry, you know? And I think that Twain leads us there up to a point but doesn't go any further. And it's not just, of course, in terms of a question of race, but just how people interact with all the complexities that we know from our own lives, right? You know, that often doesn't make it into depictions of the past or sometimes even of the present. That I wanted to bring into this story. So it is, in a sense, it gives us the outlines of that earlier story and takes us forward into what would have been the future of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but with a complexity that runs against the grain, even I think of how some, you know, people who might have a complex understanding of Jim would have written a story or thought about his life and how he sort of functioned during the period of the war.
Yes, I'm talking to John Keane about his collection, Counter Narratives. As you were saying earlier, in each of the stories, there's a moment when language disrupts. But there are many disruptions that recur in these stories. In fact, what I'd say is that these are stories you think you know until you begin to encounter the disruptions in them. My favorite of the stories is one that's called A Letter on the Trials of the Counter-Reformation in New Lisbon. Just when we've been getting used to the idea that these are going to be American stories, we're brought face up to the idea that American does not just mean North American. This is a story that takes place in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place in part in a monastery.
Mm-hmm.
A narrator has been sent to report, but we come to understand that the narrator is reporting in Portuguese,
mm-hmm.
that what he's reporting, what he's going to see, is in the sense a haunted monastery, one in which voodoo and witchcraft are being practiced. Only on the surface is this a Catholic location.
Mm-hmm.
So these are really crazy stories. I don't mean mentally ill. I mean stories in which what we expect cannot be laid out in advance, that as we read, we're being opened up to a whole new set of possibilities in fiction, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that argue that you're impatient with what's been happening in the texts that these texts are answering to?
To a certain degree, yes. So let's think about the story, A Letters on the Trials of the Counter-Reformation in New Lisbon. There is a way in which a number of these stories link historically, thematically, conceptually. And so I was really fascinated by how, for example, the Portuguese reconquest of the northeast of Brazil sent the Dutch north, but not just the Dutch. It also sent the conversos, right, and the people who were not just conversos, but who were practicing Judaism, and also African enslaved people and some free Africans north to New York. So there's that kind of connection that this story, in a sense, unearths. And there's another story actually on it called On Brazil that also contains elements of this. But almost in a kind of archaeological fashion, what's happening is each of these stories is uncovering layers and layers and layers. And once you begin to put the stories together, you can see almost a kind. It's sort of like a ghost map that then takes shape, that materializes, right? So that we get a truly rich, I hope, a truly rich sense of the past, right? Even as the stories are also engaging with, you know, the metaphysical, you know, the magical, the spiritual. And one of the ways that I also think about this is as a way of putting different types of knowledge into play, right? What happens when one way of looking at the world collides with another way of looking at the world? And we see this even today, but I mean, I think in the past, and particularly at the moments when these stories are taking place, this was actually quite common, so that, you know, what seems absolutely magical in one sense to one group of people are, you know, and, you know, unbelievable to another group of people may be their primary way of looking at the world. And what does that look like when those two different ways of thinking collide and sometimes actually even merge? So in that story, what we also begin to see is that other layers are revealed so that the, well, I don't want to give away the story, but we even learn that the person who has been sent to clean up things is hiding a kind of secret self. And in this process of sort of learning about what's going on, he comes to see that someone else can see what he's up to, right? That there's a whole nother way of thinking about the world that is revealed.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Keane about his book, Counter Narratives. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Keane about his latest book, Counter Narratives, a story that spans hundreds of characters, several centuries, an array of styles, and an epic vision of history, slavery, and poetry. Well, you see, in the third story, the Lisbon story, mm-hmm. one of the characters is a small man. Mm-hmm. But when we see him again, he'll be a small woman. Mm-hmm. He will have blonde, long hair, and he will be essentially working spells. Mm-hmm. And we're being instructed by an African-American writer, an African-American queer writer, mm-hmm. to open our boundaries and see that everything that we discover to be true has always been true. Mm-hmm. There was never a point when there weren't queer people, black people with spiritual senses that involved the miraculous. And all of these are going to enter the history of the Americas, not American history, as it travels via trade up and down the coast, so that the sense, am I getting it right, in this book is that capitalism itself is not the negative thing we're always criticizing. It becomes the conveyance of multiculture.
Yes, I think it opens capitalism in its early and developing forms, does create, I think now the term that people often use is these global flows, this kind of circulation of peoples, of cultures, of spiritualities has a long history, and it's never static. It was not static in the past, and it's not static today. It attempts to show and to create a narrative that will reveal this complex past as a way, as a kind of window. And I use the term window several times in the collection, kind of opening of a sort of portal onto our present, right? So that the things that we think of as new actually have this long prehistory, and a number of them are put into play in the various stories, but particularly in that one, queerness, blackness, multiple and alternative religious traditions, syncretism, the role of music, and we think about spirits. Think about spirits in the religious sense, spirits in the sense of even sort of catching the spirit, and how music, language, alcohol, all these things activate that, and the kind of terror that can produce. I mean, the part of what's going on in that story, I think, is a tremendous fear of what is released once one accesses certain kinds of knowledge, right? Including fear of oneself and one's own powers. So anyway, but all of those things, I think, come together, and they do point to, I think, the complexity of the past as it's reflected today.
In case we think that this is just something he started over, how many years ago was your first book?
20, a little, about 21 now, yeah.
We've had to wait 21 years. His first book was called Annotations, and now we get counter-narratives. So there was always a sense that there was something that needed correcting or countering or annotating in your work, and that has been from the very beginning. The books involve a considerable amount of research. In other words, the idea seems to be that if America would open up to the secrets brought to it from other cultures, mm-hmm. we never would have ended with the constricted, Puritan, close-minded, frightened thing that Europeans criticize us for, because we are children who cannot accept the fullness of sexual nature, the fullness of nature itself.
Mm-hmm.
We cut down our trees. So how did you figure out that this was what you wanted to do? Did this come from research, from study? What's your impetus? What's your origin point?
Well, I don't know if it came so much from research. I think I've wanted to tell stories that I didn't see already in existence. And I mean, Toni Morrison has a famous quote along those lines that's always been an inspiration, that she wrote, this is sort of my version of it, that she wrote the stories that she didn't see on the bookshelf. And I mean, I think this is the case for many writers who are doing something that's somewhat different to very different. You want to, you experience the world in certain ways, you see the world in certain ways, you imagine the world in certain ways, ways that are considered unorthodox or queer, in the broadest sense of that term. And you want to then find a language to convey it. And so that's, I think, what's been at the heart of my writing from the beginning. even though, of course, at the same time, I want people to read the work. So with these stories, I mean, I thought, you know, there are avenues into readers' expectations. So why not pursue some of those? Why not walk down some of those? So there's, you know, at moments, you know, the genre of the detective story, for example, there is a lot of humor here, sometimes a really kind of dark humor or ironic humor. But there are ways, I think, that the stories open themselves up to readers, even with the difficulties that they challenge. But even using some of those older forms, those older genres, is also a way of trying to forge a new language, a new way of thinking.
Where does this book end up?
Well, I was thinking at a certain point. This probably wasn't at when I was first conceiving the book, but well into writing it, I realized that I was drawing a line from the beginning of modernity through modernism, with, I guess, the Black Atlantic being the sort of foundation or the backdrop. So the Atlantic, the Black Atlantic, the Circum-Atlantic, the African diaspora. I wanted to think about what might be an outcome of all of these earlier moments in present time. And I wanted, rather than staying in what we might call the New World or our hemisphere, to go to the Old World, to go, but not to Europe, but to Africa, to imagine, okay, what we think about this process of freedom, right? Where might it lead? And so that's how we end up with that story, The Lions.
In a story called The Lions, we have an epigraph from Ludwig Wittgenstein. If a lion could talk, we would not understand him. And I would say that that quote stands in for and addresses all of the reasons why you would read these stories again and again and again, because these lions are talking, and if you give them time, you'll understand them. I would say, you know, that every once in a while you encounter a writer and you say, well, I'm going to read everything he does, whether it's translation, whatever you do next, John Keane, I'm going to be reading it. In the meantime, I have the pleasure of appreciating and rereading Counter Narratives, a collection of stories and novellas, and a autobiographical book, much shorter, called Annotations. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Counter Narratives at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is acting as producer today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Our engineer today is Philip Richards. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Scott Berg is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.